It's a beautiful morning. I think I'll go outside for a while.
Just smile.
Just taking some clean, fresh air for me.
Don't stay inside.
If the weather's fine and you got the time, it's your chance to wake up and plan another brand new day.
Good morning, Barcelona. Welcome to Thursday in English Radio on RKB 106.9 FM. I'm Virgil, still and always. Over the past couple of weeks, I've talked about the latest trends in research around better treatments for advanced stage cancers and the developments of a potential cure. We want to continue that conversation today in advance of a special educational symposium being held tomorrow, sponsored by the Prostate Net and Bayer Healthcare. But joining us today are two very special guests, all specialists in prostate cancer. Investigators Dr. Mariana Kreuthofer de Julio, Dr. Nahal Mohammed, urological surgeon and research advocate Dr. Frank Chinigunda,
perfect,
and patient research and outreach professional Mr. Everett Dotson. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as I mentioned, tomorrow at the Hotel Barcelona 1882 from 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock, we're going to have a free breakfast symposium talking about advanced stage prostate cancer. Well, space is limited, so please call 629-827-452 to reserve your spot. But let me ask all of you, why do you think it's important for patients and families to come to this conference?
Well, Virgil, I think that one of the most important things is to raise awareness for prostate cancer. So I think what you do here at the ProstateNet and, with the advocacy is just fantastic to bring this awareness so that patients and people can just understand how prevention is important.
Well, Dr. Frank, you deal with patients every day.
Yes, I do. And one of the things that's saddens me is when a patient presents late with their prostate cancer, and I'm yet to meet a patient who comes late who didn't wish that they had come earlier, who didn't wish that they had known about prostate cancer, who didn't wish that they were aware of the PSA blood tests. So the more awareness raising that we can do, and the more people come and are diagnosed earlier, the better it'll be.
I think, Dr. Mohammed, you are involved, obviously, talking with patients and also doing research. I mean, what does this mean to you to be able to have patients come in and learn more about the disease?
I think this is really important because we are so good in terms of providing the clinical care and cancer control for patients, but we are not so good in understanding their unmet needs, whether the information they need about prostate cancer and treatment options, or their health care needs, like what kind of support they need to adhere to the clinical protocol and follow-up checkup after cancer treatment. So I believe it's really important for us to understand all these issues so that we could enhance the health care that we provide to patients and their families.
Perfect. Now, I mean, you every day are out there in the community, talking to folks, trying to convince them. What are some of the barriers you've seen that you've had to deal with that we could address with this?
Well, first, there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of misperceptions. And then right now in the States, there's a lot of just in whether or not the testing is really beneficial. And so it's getting questionable. Now we're starting to see research in the opposite direction that shows the testing is very beneficial. But a lot of men don't understand that because they feel well, they don't feel anything, they think they're fine. We're trying to convince them that you don't want to wait until you're starting to have symptoms. Generally you have symptoms, just something that's well developed. So the idea, like this breakfast tomorrow, you give them in the information they need so they can understand that they need to do regular screening. You have an early diagnosis, then you have very good options for treatment, and then good chance for recovery and probably not have any problems in the future. But going along and not having regular testing after a certain age and giving things a chance to start and then to grow, then you come in, you may get diagnosed with something that's already well developed, maybe even spread outside of the prostate, which is going to be very difficult to treat and lessens your options for treatment. And then also it plays a part on your quality of life also.
Well, we'll be back to talk more with our guests right after this. And that was Summer Madness by Kool and the Gang. And yeah, we're in the, getting ready to be into summer. A little chilly this morning, but it's going to be a great day. Now, Dr. Frank, as a urologist, you know, you see, you're the specialist that a man sees when making decisions about the type of treatment they should have. Now, we can assume that the man may choose surgery to cure his disease, but in a certain number of cases, even after your best efforts, the cancer comes back. Now, is this qualified as advanced stage cancer? And if so, why?
It may not necessarily be advanced stage cancer, But just to take one step back, we have as many patients undergoing radiation treatment of one sort or another as we do surgery. There's a misconception that if you have surgery, it must be curative and it can't recur because how can it? Because your prostate's gone. So, you know, we have to educate the men before they have surgery that it's possible that a cancer cell has escaped and is lodged in the pelvis, which is why you can get recurrence and which is why we follow these men up. If the PSA rises after you've had a radical prostatectomy, we wouldn't count that as advanced disease necessarily. We would get scans and see if there's anything visible on the scans, follow the PSA closely, and at a certain point offer them radiation to kind of salvage their radical prostatectomy. And often, if you get the recurrence early enough, radiation is very effective.
Hmm. So now, talking about that, then, you know, even though you would have radiation and you have it, and we know at times even the radiation, it isn't going to kill all the cells because the cells, once they escape the capsule, can be anywhere. Now, at that point when radiation, you know, fails, let's say, and the cancer returns, mm-hmm. what's then the next option?
Well, it then becomes kind of more challenging to treat. So if we feel that the cancer is still localized to the pelvis, so, for example, if they've had radiation as their primary therapy and the cancer recurs because the PSA goes up, then we'll often offer them another local therapy, such as salvage cryotherapy, because the prostate is still there, or high-intensity focused ultrasound. Now, in a situation where you've had radical prostatectomy and then you've had radiotherapy as well and still the cancer comes back because your PSA is going up, we will then get a PET scan, which is a very sophisticated way of scanning to see if there's any prostate cancer spread outside the pelvis. And depending on that will depend on the therapy that the man gets offered. Often it's hormonal therapy, where we try and reduce the man's testosterone. At times we offer chemotherapy alongside the hormonal therapy. But it's very much tailored to the individual. It's very much tailored to what's happening with their PSA. It's tailored to whether they've got symptoms or not, and it's tailored to the comorbidities. But I think the important thing to emphasize is by this stage, they should be under the care of an oncologist, not a urologist.
Right.
There are places and there are situations where urologists may be very well-meaning, hang on to these patients too long.
Right.
And we don't, as urologists, have the expertise really to be dealing with advanced prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. The field of advanced prostate cancer is changing all the time. There are newer and newer drugs coming out, newer therapies, and which order you use them and how long you use them for and how you judge a response is very complex. So once our local therapies have failed, it's over to the oncologists to do their best for the man.
Now, Dr. Mariana, you're involved, obviously, in doing research on cellular structures and tumor biologies. Now, talk to us a little about the cell. Dr. Frank talked about us in terms of the cells escaping and then are replicating the cancer. Now, in the course of that cell, how does a normal cell become a cancer cell? And then how does that cancer cell become a metastatic cell?
Well, that's a question that is like the chicken and the egg question. And so, well, there's several theories. And although the science has advanced tremendously in the last decades, I think we still don't really know how a cancer cell becomes a cancer cell. So what we do know is that there is a genetic predisposition in us humans to develop the cancer. But how some of these and some individuals obtain it and it progresses, that is still trying to understand. But the idea behind it is basically that in this cancer, there are many different kinds of cells, and they all have kind of different potentials. And these potentials drive these cells outside of the cancer into our blood flow, and then somehow they manage to stick on the vessel walls and kind of creep into their niches around the body. And then the cancer cells seem to be really smart in terms of outsmarting our own immune system, because they manage to hide from us, you know, because our immune system is our greatest defense from the outside world. But somehow these cancer cells manage to hide themselves from the immune system and then all of a sudden show up and grow. And that's what Dr. Frank was talking about, the reoccurrence, which basically means that although you have a local therapy, you can have these cells that have gone wandering around, and they may take years of what we call a latent period to then manifest themselves. And that's why it's so important for a patient to understand that after a radical prostatectomy, he still has to be followed up, because we want to make sure that he lives a long and healthy life and that we can always catch this recurrence early. Because right now, our biggest weapon against cancer is prevention. And that's what is so important that you do, is that raising this awareness for prevention, because people should not be afraid to go to the urologist.
Absolutely not. Now, the thing is, you know, we talked about a little bit, Dr. Mohammed, following on with Dr. Mariano, was saying that we have the presence of cells, and I've often heard it said that most men will die with prostate cancer as opposed to men who die from prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. So that the prostate cancer cells are really part of our physiognomy, and whether they become lethal or not is, you know, dependent upon many, many things. Mm-hmm. Now, you deal with men who are involved and who are at high risk for prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. How do you talk to this? I mean, since we all have these cancer cells inside of us, you know, who is at high risk for then developing cancer?
That's a very good question. And when we talk about that to these men, we always discuss the family history. If they have it in the family, that means they are more vulnerable to this kind of cancers. We also talk about lifestyle and their decision to have, you know, healthy diet versus not healthy diet, physical active lifestyle versus sedentary lifestyle, exposure to stress versus meditation and other ways of relaxation. So everything we do in our everyday life can make us more vulnerable to cancer. So we try to educate these men about, you know, risk of having cancer in addition to the genetic factors, as we heard before. So what could we do to minimize our risk is really important. That's why we're developing interventions and educational material supported by grant organizations like the Department of Defense, the American Cancer Society, and the National Cancer Institute in America, to develop this kind of pamphlets, as you will, or educational materials to help men understand what they can do and what they can do to minimize the risk of having cancer. We believe, as we heard before, prevention is the key. So in order to reduce our chances of having cancer, we really need to understand what makes us more vulnerable to cancer.
No, we talked a little bit, you know, you just mentioned the fact of stress.
Yes.
Now, everybody says, I'm under stress. You know, I talk to people here, they say, oh, I'm stressed. I said, you haven't lived in New York, so you don't know what stress, you don't know what stress is. You know, but again, what is stress? I mean, we hear all kinds of things talking about stress.
Yes.
What is it?
Well, stress is our emotional reaction to what we think of as problematic in life. It could be a specific situation, like, for example, you're going through a driving test tomorrow. So you feel like excited, but under stress, because your chances of failing the driving test, according to your estimation, are high. So that's where you feel this emotional excitement, which is very negative feeling, that makes you agitated. if you will. So these are the kind of feelings that people have when they think of stress and a stressful situation. It's a physical reaction as well as emotional situation. Unfortunately, we are exposed to stress in everyday life from small things like, for example, going through the subway system in New York.
Yeah.
Or Barcelona.
Or Barcelona. Or, you know, receiving a diagnosis of cancer. This is the most, I think, stressful condition that everybody could be exposed to for the patient and the families. So it's really important to know that this reaction is normal, but at the same way, we need to know how we can deal with it. There are ways that we could deal with the stress in our lives, like meditation, as I said, maybe prayers, maybe support from the family members, how we, you know, receive this reassuring feelings that there are people around us that we could rely on in time of need. So I think that's really important.
Okay. Well, we'd like to talk more with Mariana, Nihal, Frank, and Everett right after this. We'll be right back. And that was Christian McBride with The Middleman. Now, obviously, advanced stage disease is not a desired condition, you know, but what does a man need to do in order to best prevent or foresee the situation? You know, Everett, you know, you talk with men on a regular basis. How do you counsel them?
Well, first of all, they need to continue to work with their urologist. And as Dr. Frank mentioned earlier, they get to a point with the advanced disease, they need to continue with an oncologist. And don't come up with these reasons not to keep their appointments. I've seen it was screening programs and arranging for men to get in to see a doctor, and, you know, they'll come back and say, well, you know, something came up, I didn't go, can you, you know, reschedule me? You know, that is not going to benefit you. Get them to understand when you're talking about advanced disease, you're talking about something that is spreading and is much more difficult to treat than the isolated cancer that's in the prostate and that's been maintained in the prostate. And, you know, when you hear about disease, someone starts out with prostate cancer, and then at some point they'll say they have cancer in another organ. They think sometimes they'll refer to it as the cancer from that particular organ. And getting them to understand, no, your disease has spread from your prostate into that organ. So it's important to continue to follow your doctor's instructions. If you need whatever treatments that are needed, you know, this is something that at the advanced stage you just cannot ignore. And so when we're talking about early stage disease, we're talking about treatment that, you know, curative or certainly is going to be life extending. But if you don't do the same thing with advanced disease, then you're looking at, you know, life being cut short, having really poor quality of life, because as the disease continues to spread, then it's going to affect you in other ways. You're going to have organs shut down. So get them to understand that these are all things that can happen that can really make it difficult for you to function every day. Not less to mention that, you know, eventually this is something that can kill you.
Right. Well, you know, things we talked about, you know, Dr. Frank, you mentioned, you know, a little bit about progression and how that, you know, certain treatment modalities fail, and we try something else and we continue to try something else. What do we know about progression? I mean, how long does it take? You know, I mean, how much time can you buy for yourself? Because they say it's a slow-growing disease, and there is, you know, it's not going to necessarily kill you tomorrow, but, you know, what are we looking at?
Well, if we're talking about advanced disease, it's very variable.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be a short time, so it's not always slow-growing, or it can be a long time. So, you know, I've had patients present with advanced disease from the off. I've got one patient that's 18 years later, I'm still treating him. Others 14 years, some not as long as that, some maybe one or 2 years. So it's incredibly variable. And why some people can go on through all the various treatments for like best part of 20 years with advanced disease, and others it's much shorter, that's elusive to us. But certainly one of the things that that we recommend, and in fact has been shown to slow down the advance of disease, is regular exercise. Mm. So exercise is very important indeed. You know, there's good evidence. In fact, we're reaching a stage now of prescribing exercise to men in the UK. The other thing which was alluded to earlier on was the lifestyle and diet. Diet is incredibly important. Mm. So we advise men to have a diet for the fruit and vegetables, cut down on the red meat, and more fish and white meat. Brazil nuts are good. Pomegranates are good. So there's some very good dietary advice, which we're sure helps. The third thing that we tell men, so the first thing has been exercise, the second is a diet, is we believe that vitamin D is good for you. Mm. So we tell men to get out into the sun and bare their chests. And, you know, don't be shy. Don't be shy. You need to make vitamin D.
Get some sun
onto your sun onto your skin, and we think that's beneficial. So you know you can. So you know, a lot of these men we get to know very well because we're with them for very, very many years. You know, So we say, take your shirt off and run around the park when it's sunny. And, you know, we have a laugh about that. But there is a serious message behind that. So I think quite apart from all the various drugs and the various treatments that we put men through, how they conduct themselves, how they conduct their lives, I think is important.
It's really essential. Now, both you, Dr. Nahal, Dr. Mariano, we talked about the causes of cancer. Now, cancer is not a new thing. Cancer has been around for centuries. And obviously a lot of people will say, well, you know, if it's been around here, then maybe there should be a cure that's been around, you know, for centuries as well. And so you see a lot of guys talking about going to take herbal medicines and all other kinds of homeopathic things. Is there, you know, based in nature, some possible, if not cure for cancer, some forestalling mechanisms, you know, some things that we could eat or take or do that would slow down the cancers?
Well, first of all, let me say that I think that cancer is a series of unfortunate events that happen all together in a human body. And I don't believe that there is a one herbal medicine or one chemical compound, for that matters, that will cure this this cancer. I think we are scientifically proceeding really fast in trying to understand the underlying biology of the cancer. And I think that we've learned really a lot. And I think that at one point we will find a way to probably not cure the primary cancer, but at least contain it so that it will not become metastatic, and it will ultimately not kill the patient. There are many things that people can do to help themselves not get cancer, or at least reduce their chances, like stop smoking would be one of them. But changing also the mentality of people and how people approach their life is not an easy task. And I think that the close collaboration of patient advocacy, patients, scientists, and clinicians all together is what is going to, at one point, work. So I think we should keep on working with all four groups closely, because we can't do research without our partnering patients.
Right.
And they cannot get cured without the partnering scientists and clinicians. Right. So to answer your question is, I don't know if there is one herbal medication that can help.
Well, I threw it out, began dealing with my own prostate cancer. I had been a practitioner of Asian medicines and philosophies for a long time. So when I got diagnosed, I went to my Chinese doctor, you know, who had been doing acupuncture and acupressure on me for years. And I said, well, you know, what do you do? She says, well, we can't cure cancer. However, we can have things that will help your immune system be able to be strong enough to fight. And then once you have your treatment, we'll come back to help, you know, regenerate. And so we did. You know, and she prescribed a series of bones and roots and twigs and stuff, and you made a tea. And again, I can say that I had an excellent surgeon. But hey, 24 years later, with no additional recurrence, you know, it's like one of those things, like I told Dr. Frank earlier, you know, I don't know if it helped, but it couldn't hurt. Dr. Mohammed, I mean, from your standpoint, I mean, what do you think about it? Are there things that you talk to men about in terms of, you know, the natural things that they can do?
Actually, this is one of the things that we discuss a lot after the treatment, because men usually would like to have some sort of control, things that they could do to enhance their chances of surviving cancer and treatment. So we really encourage them to think about diet and nutrition and also herbal therapies, because if there is no evidence that they could cure cancer by themselves. They can help men control some side of the side effects and the symptoms. For example, herbal tea is good for relaxation. Improving diet and nutrition is good for your immune system, as you just mentioned. Another kind of like meditation, cognitive therapies, and all the sort that could enhance your psychological well-being and give you some sort of relaxation is good, because we know from ongoing research that stress is related to cancer recurrence. So we try to reduce stress by different means. One of them is to use herbal therapies, meditation, natural treatment, and give men some sort of control on their own outcomes.
Well, you're listening to 106.9 FM, Radio Canal Barcelona, English Radio Thursday. We'll be back with our guest right after this. And that was Stacy Kent with Landslide. Now, a few years back, there was a major controversy in the States about the PSA test and recommendations for its use, which in the States it was deemed as one point, not beneficial, and it resulted in a major increase in advanced stage prostate cancer at first diagnosis. That's been changed somewhat, but the damage has been done. Have we seen similar experiences to this in Europe or in Africa?
We've not seen similar to that in Europe. Africa is, and particularly sub-Saharan Africa, is a kind of a different kind of situation where there isn't widespread knowledge and awareness of prostate cancer, and certainly not widespread testing. Now, even in the UK, we've never had, and we don't have, a screening kind of program. And so, despite the American recommendations kind of, you know, downplaying the role of PSA, that didn't really affect us in the UK because we don't have a widespread PSA testing in the first place. But I think it was a serious error of judgment.
No question at all about that.
It was a serious error of judgment, which, as you say, Virgil, is being recognized, and the disease at advanced disease at diagnosis has gone up. There's a direct correlation.
Absolutely. Now, Dr. Mohammed, you know, you've done a lot of work in the area of active surveillance mm-hmm. as a treatment for prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. Now, what type of patient is this best indicated for, and what happens if his disease begins to progress?
Mm-hmm. That's a very important issue. As or based on the criteria for selection of patients for this specific management protocol, we believe the patients who are best suited for active surveillance are patients with low-risk prostate cancer, which means early stage of prostate cancer. These patients have really better chance to continue having the same levels of quality of life, which means no side effects of active treatment such as surgery and radiation, because active surveillance avoids all that.
Well, what is active surveillance? Tell us a little bit about that.
Active surveillance is a protocol that requires men to be on a frequent on a program of frequent testing based on blood results and biopsy annually to see how cancer progresses over time. The protocol differs from one country to another. That's another problem. There is no consistency of, the type of test and the frequency of test included in this protocol. But it's a very attractive management option for men because, as I mentioned before, it avoids all the side effects associated with surgery and radiation, such as the erectile dysfunction and the urinary incontinence and pain and other issues. So we believe men are suited if they are prepared emotionally to live with the idea that cancer is still inside their bodies. Okay. The tolerance for stress, again, stress is the key, because if you are living with it, then every day will be a reminder exactly what will happen if cancer progresses.
Now, Dr. Frank, you know, as a urologist, you actually do active surveillance as a normal thing with patients.
Yes.
At what point is the trigger for you to say to them, okay, active surveillance no longer works for you, you got to do something else now?
So there's often no absolute trigger. It's a conversation with the man. In terms of how we monitor these men, we do the PSAs, the blood test, every 3 months. We do what we call a multi-parametric MRI scan once a year. And currently we're doing a transperineal prostate biopsy once every 18 to 24 months. Now, if one or more of these parameters are going in the wrong direction, then that will trigger us to suggest perhaps active surveillance is not working for you. So if, for example, you know, the PSA may be fairly stable, but on the MRI scan, you see new areas of disease within the prostate gland, and then you do another biopsy, and the cells look worse than they did when they were initially diagnosed, then you would say, perhaps this isn't working for you, and then we then explore the options of surgery or external radiation or brachytherapy, radioactive implants into the prostate gland. Now, the MRI is getting to we're getting to that level of expertise with the MRI scan, where if the MRI looks normal, or at least the same as it did at diagnosis, we may forego doing the actual repeat biopsy. But at the moment, many active surveillance regimes have a mandatory rebiopsy of the prostate at 18 to 24 months.
Right. Now, Everett, obviously, I think, you know, we're seeing more active surveillance in the States, you know, with men there choosing that as an option as opposed to surgery or radiation. Now, as, you know, Dr. Mohammed and Dr. Frank talks about, you know, there's the risk that, you know, it will become, at some point, we've got to take more aggressive action. You talked a little bit about expectations. How does the man then deal with it from the standpoint of saying, well, I'm using active surveillance, and now all of a sudden they tell me I've got to have surgery? How do you talk about that, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah. Well, one of the things we've been seeing with in the States, a lot of men, even though they may choose active surveillance at the beginning, they, as Dr. Muhammad was saying, they continue to think about the fact that they have this cancer in them. So a lot of the research shows a lot of men at about a year decide, even if there's no indication that their cancer is growing, that they're going to go ahead and have treatment because they just can't get it out of their mind that they have a cancer in their body that, you know, is not being treated. And, you know, they wonder if they're going to be in a situation at some point they wake up and they're not feeling well and they go and there's been an explosion and a great, you know, invasion of other parts of the body from the cancer all of a sudden. So I think that unknown plays on their mind. So it's, again, getting them, you know, trying to get them to understand that they need to have a close or feel positive about talking to the urologist about this particular disease and their choices. You know, again, as Dr. Frank was saying, you know, you do take precautions with men who are on active surveillance. And I wonder just how many men get to a point where they just can get it out of their mind and just go ahead and perform on a daily basis and don't let it be a thought. So just trying, the men that I talk to who are in that situation, you know, at some point they're, especially if they've had a family member with prostate cancer. Unfortunately, I do see men or talk to men who have had a family member, father or uncle, who may have died from the prostate cancer. So even though theirs may be at a point where, and they're active surveillance or they're considering active surveillance, they can't get it out of their mind that this close family member died from the prostate cancer. And so it's something that sticks with them. And so I think, you know, it really takes some real decision-making, you know, to stay on the active surveillance because as Dr. Muhammad was talking about stress, you know, that's a considerable stress to be, you know, that, and I'm sure it's something that you will visit more than once a day, you know. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we'll be back for some closing comments right after this.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. As many times as we've loved, shared love, and made love, it doesn't seem to me like it's ever, ever enough. It's just not enough. No. No matter.
And that was Taylor Dane with Can't Get Enough of Your Love. Let me just remind you again, folks, tomorrow at 9 o'clock, the Hotel 1882 Barcelona on Córcega, we're going to have our symposium on advanced stage prostate cancer. So a lot of the stuff we talked about today, we're going to be talking about in depth there tomorrow. So call 629-827-452 to reserve your seat for tomorrow's symposium and free breakfast. You know, we're talking about a lot of the things here as related to research and treatment. And one of the things we're hearing about in terms of the future is immunotherapy. We've seen some places that has worked, other places hasn't worked as well. What can you tell us about immunotherapy, Dr. Mariana?
So our immune system has a remarkable capability to go and attack that is harmful for our body. Cancer, on the other hand, has a remarkable ability of hiding from our immune system. So the idea of immunotherapy is basically to go in, hack the immune system, and retrain the immune system to show it what is harmful. That is the idea behind it. Does this apply to all cancers? Unfortunately not. Does this apply to prostate cancer? Not so much. There is more evidence now coming up that there are some subtypes of prostate cancers that could be susceptible to this kind of therapy. So that's the idea in terms of immune therapy.
So not ready for prime time, but it's got some hope for the future.
It has hope for the future, yes. And I think that at the end, as I said, there will be no one cure fits all, but it will be a combination of things. So it might be that some other treatment might prone the cancer towards another treatment, and this other treatment might be then the immune therapy.
Right. Well, I thank all of you for being here today. It's been fantastic to have you. In fact, this is like the second day, or third day we've been together. And it's been fun, it's been good, and I appreciate all of you being here to share what you know with us. And we'll have you back in Barcelona again so that you can continue to give us the good information. We're going to leave all of you today with a song by Amy Winehouse, who left us again early for sadness. Her backup singer and protege, Zaylon, with a great love song. Have a fantastic day, Barcelona, and we'll see you next week.
Was I lost? I'm not a lonely man. Just trying to understand. Oh, baby.
Why we fall in love just to fall apart?
Seems to me that people fool themselves. Should be with someone else.
But they try to fix what's broken from the start. Oh,